Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. And that's a song called Hey Paula from Paula and Paula. And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. John Kelly here until 9 o'clock this Sunday night, the night we get someone in to pick the tracks. And tonight it is poet Paula Meehan. Hey Paula.
Hi, hi.
Big introduction there.
Yeah, and that song was used to persecute me as a child.
I suspected it might.
Yeah.
1962 that came out. So, hey, Paul, it's good to have you here. Mm. And I'm sorry for persecuting you with the song straight away.
It's great to be here, John, and thank you for the invitation.
And I'm looking forward to this. Paula, as you may know, is one of our very finest poets. And we'll be talking about all that tonight and, of course, the musical choices that she's going to pick. And maybe we'll start off with a tune, Paula, before we get into anything much. Mm-hmm. Susan McKeown is your first choice. Tell me about Susan.
Well, it's Susan, and this particular song, which is the lyrics are by that great old American singer, Emily Dickinson, Hoedown Dickinson, as we know her. And this was the first, these were the first poems I ever saw Emily Dickinson. It was a book in my grandfather's house. And my aunt had been doing a line with an American student who was in Trinity College. And when he was leaving to go back to the States in 1958, he inscribed a book to her, To Pat, From Pat. I hope you enjoy this great American poet as much as I do. So it was one of those books lying around the house. And I opened it and I saw poetry for the first time.
Yeah.
And I thought they looked like the little stanzas. I thought they looked like little jewels in a setting. I just sussed that there was some kind of power off them. Now, I couldn't have articulated that. I was just a child. But Susan McKeown, who made her young life in New York, and she's come home recently in the last few years to a great return, and has brought back all this harvest of song. She has a Grammy for klezmer, singing Yiddish folk songs. Mm-hmm. And she's fantastic because she's picked up poetry and she's put tunes to poems both from her own tradition and from the American tradition, of course, and the English tradition. And some Nuala Nigono, she sings Nuala Nigono. But this one I love because it links me back to my grandparents' house, and also because you'll hear the voice of Natalie Merchant, the great American folk singer and carrier of the tradition. So you'll hear her voice coming in to harmonise.
Terrific. And this is Because I Could Not Stop for Death. Susan McKeown with Natalie Merchant there, the first choice of Paula Meehan, who's my guest tonight in studio, picking the tracks, and Because I Could Not Stop for Death. And that's Emily Dickinson. And I was just saying to you there, Paula, that without starting the whole debate about poets and poetry and lyrics and is Bob Dylan a poet, all that, we no need to go there. But just to say that I've heard poetry set to music before, and it can be kind of complicated because for the music to accommodate the words, it calls for complex music. But that's a song we all know. We could sing along with that straight away. Familiar.
It's in the folk idiom. And an awful lot of lyric poetry is aligned and close sister to song. Emily Dickinson, a lot of her songs are in the hymn meters that she would have heard as a child in Amherst. I mean, a 19th century poet, she led a reclusive life, which I'm convinced she led so she wouldn't have to be kind of embroidering kneelers for the church, which would have been the fate of a lot of daughters at the time. But you can sing nearly all her songs. You can sing them to bluegrass tunes too, really easily.
Yeah.
So, you know, she's graven into the American folk tradition. But an awful lot of what we consider like high literary form came originally from songs of the people, like the ballad was a folk idiom, and it was taken up then by the romantics, the literary ballads, and some people think elevated. I myself think it might have degenerated slightly in the hands of the poets. Or the sonnet, which was originally a little song in 15th century Sicily. When Alan Lomax went down collecting Sicilian folk song in the 50s, he has these fantastic, crude, very sexual agricultural songs, you know, with hens being chased by cocks and rams getting at the ewes, really earthy. And, you know, you can see the lineaments of the sonnet, the little song, sonetto, in them. And the villanelle, which is another elevated form, literary form, goes back to the slave songs of the Roman farms, the slave farms of the Romans. And that's very like, with its repetition of two lines, very like the slave songs of the American South.
Sure.
So, you know, at the heart of high literary action, there's often these folk songs of the people. And sometimes the closer you get back to them, in the spirit of them anyway, maybe the more singable the poetry is. But I think that just in all human endeavour, once a thing reaches the full extent of the pendulum swing, it swings back again. And like, we're in the middle of a big folk revival, like all the kids are either hip-hopping or folk reviving around the place.
Yeah. And they're the same thing, aren't
they?
Same thing.
Yeah. But there's a lovely continuity. And I mean, anyone who is a lyric poet can't go too far from the song.
Mm. Good advice. Now, poetry, where did it begin for you, Paula? Where was home?
Oh, all over the place. Yeah. I mean, even though I sometimes put it about that I'm well rooted in the north inner city of Dublin, and that is a place and a community I really love, because I was very conscious of getting language there. And, you know, it wasn't until I went to school that I was told I was underprivileged. But actually, in retrospect, I had a fantastic childhood of privilege if you're going to be a poet, because often what oppresses you is the very stuff that energizes what you write.
Well, whereabouts in the north inner city, and when, and sort of how different was that, again, as you say, underprivileged state? How different would that be compared to today, say, in the same place?
Well, it was pretty well for Ireland. It was probably multicultural because we were near the docks. And of course, my people go back into Monto. So that would have been, you know, where my grandmother used to say to me, everybody in Monto has blue blood in them. So, I mean, it was always a rich community and neighbourhood. So we go back in there. My schooling was in the central, my primary schooling was in the Central Model Girls School there on Gardiner Street. And it was coming up like to the 50th anniversary of the Easter Rising. So we were like being primed to go out and die for Ireland. We couldn't wait to get out there and die for Ireland. So there's a lot of ballads,
a lot
of the revolutionary songs.
Were you really? Because you
know, that was 11 years of age.
Yeah,
you know,
but growing up in the north, our assumption was that nobody in the Free State had the slightest idea about it anymore. That it all had faded away. You know.
Oh, not in 1966, not in the schools.
Yeah.
It might have faded away outside, but we were part of the official celebration of the state.
Yeah.
And boy, were we going to remember it in all its gory detail. At the same time, I was living in that community in Sean McDermott Street with, you know, very cruel reminders of the actual effect of the revolutionary era. On that neighbourhood, you know, because it was just blitzed. And then we had all the old soldiers. I remember as a child, my mother pointing out the old soldiers, you know, people with one arm or people gone in the head with the mustard gas. And my mother would say, they're the old men from the trenches, you know. So even though the air, like we were in school learning how to wave flags and talk the talk, actually at home there was a counterbalance.
Sure.
But the ballads were huge, both in the school and then in like my father's younger brother, Michael, would come with his gang and guitars, and there'd be sing songs in the house. And there'd be sing songs in my granny's house and party pieces. But the ballads, I remember that, them hitting. And it was all the Rocky Road to Dublin, and it was all around my hat I wear the tri-coloured ribbon. Oh, mm-hmm. You know, it was all, you know, tales of derring do and death, the foggy dew. Fantastic material, I have to say.
It sounds really rich. And, you know, I'm always conscious that you hear people going on about Dublin in those days. The rare old times, exactly. And you get kind of suspicious of it, and you think, I bet you it wasn't as good as you're making out. But what you're saying to me sounds pretty rich and wonderful,
people,
you know.
Singing and having a few drinks and celebrating. But the day-to-day grind.
Yeah.
I mean, my parents were back and forth to London. I was regularly left with my grandparents while my parents went to get work, you know. The 50s were grim. And I remember even in the tenements, like, you know, people living in unbelievable situation. And one of the girls in my class, Claire Reid, who lived in Corporation Buildings, 13 in the family in two rooms, she died of diphtheria in the 60s.
Yeah.
Diphtheria. You know, so I have no romance. I don't romanticize that childhood, but I do see it for the extraordinary gift that it was to me.
And, you know, I was thinking of the Dubliners there when you mentioned all of those songs. And of course, they sang a song about the Monto.
Yeah.
And that's how I learned that Montgomery Street was the red light district.
Queen, she came to call on us. Yeah. I'm glad she didn't fall on us.
She's 18 stone.
Lovely. Of course, I wasn't told in the family that we were connected to the Monto that way, you know, that we had actually brothels in the family. I heard that through Terry Fagan of the North Inner City Folklore Project, came up to me on the street in the 80s and said, I have great stuff on your great granny.
Now, that's considerable news to be given at a certain point in life,
oh,
I'd say.
Fantastic. It explained a lot, you know, it explained a great deal of... Yeah.
What was her name? Was she well known? Was she mentioned in Ulysses, for instance?
Oh, well, she was the next generation.
Right.
Right. But her house on what was Lower Tyrone Street, present day Railway Street, her house is the setting for that chapter in Ulysses where they're in the brothel.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
but it would have been
the
madam before her. So she was the next generation, and she would have negotiated the decline of the Monto when the British Army pulled out and the docks went into decline. She was one of the first
madams.
And the
Legion of Mary moved in.
Yeah, well, she was she was the first madam to parley with Frank Duff.
Wow.
Now, in our family, they say she got religious mania at the end of her life, but I think she was just political in that she negotiated the situation, and seemingly she left property to Duff for fallen women, for the rehabilitation of fallen women. So I'm always wondering, could I actually get that back?
What was her name, Paula?
Anna Meehan.
Anna Meehan.
Anna Plunkett of Purdon Street.
Wow.
I found her in the records, but Anna Meehan, Mrs. Meehan, she'd be known as.
They really, not who do you think you are thing, they really should have, you know, it should have been you.
Oh, it should have been me, definitely. It's fascinating stuff.
Isn't it, yeah?
Yeah.
Your next musical choice is Motherland. Here's Natalie Merchant again.
Yeah,
actually.
I thought she'd link in, and I love this because it's, you know, I've always experienced the island as a mother.
Yeah.
Mm,
okay,
our island.
We can talk about that afterwards. Here it comes. Natalie Merchant, a song called Motherland. Paula Meehan with me in studio tonight on Mystery Train, picking all the tracks. Paula, just before that, you said you see Ireland as a mother.
Yeah, now, absolutely.
Tell me more about that, because there's that corny notion of Mother Ireland, you know?
Yeah, not that Mother Ireland.
Not that one, right.
And not a Mother Ireland that's kind of gathered up to some nationalist cause. Not that at all.
And
in fact,
you know,
I couldn't get further away from it.
And then what James Joyce said, the sow, et cetera,
yeah,
et cetera.
Yeah, devouring her children.
Yeah.
No, definitely not that idea of the mother. But in the terms of the nourishment, I think we have strange trope in our heads about the island, thinking of it as a bioregion, quite apart from politics and traditions and all that. And we always concentrate, you know, all my life I've been hearing, ah, the millions that had to go, ah, the millions who died. But, you know, there's very little room given to the nourishment and the fact that we're sitting here talking and that the land can continue to nourish us. You know, the other side of it, the ones who survived, you know, these terrible, terrible historical afflictions. So I just feel in that song, which has elements of lullaby and soothing and just the rhythm of it and her voice, which has, she has Indigenous blood, Native American blood. So I think she carries that kind of long, long, long survival. I just think that we need to look at the land as a source of nourishment now, right over the island. And not in a romantic way, but in a way that will sustain us, because it's under threat. And I just feel it's time. And I think it is happening. Like, you see it in small ways in community gardens and grow your own, and people's concerns about the nourishment they're getting from what they put in their mouths. Mm-hmm. So we have an incredible island, you know. And if we can just change the attitude to it, I think it could open up ways of making sustainable livings. And I think even the fact that that word is so popular now, though, like accountability and transparency, those kind of words can be just buzzing without having any substance. Mm-hmm. But it is my hope that we would have an evolutionary leap that will really show us just how much we need to protect and how much wealth we have in the land. A change of attitude to the very land we live on could have great positive effects in the future.
Okay, let's go back a bit now. Let's go back to the school you're at in Gardiner Street.
Yeah.
What was it called? A girls' model?
The Central Model Girls'
Central
School.
Central Model Girls'
Where we
School.
Got essentially a Victorian education. I spent 3 years learning to turn the heel of a sock. And I learned the run and fell scheme, seam. I learned to make neat buttonholes. We read quite an amount of Victorian literature because the old Victorian school books were still in the cupboards, and on boring afternoons Miss Shannon would distribute these old, so you'd be reading Kipling and, you know, life out in the colonies. So I'm sure I have a colonised mind from all that, but it was fascinating stuff. And
if
you know,
it wasn't that, it was 1916.
Yeah. I mean, fantastic. And of course, they still had corporal punishment. So this is the big question of my life. Was it all beaten into me or was it beaten out of me?
Well, as someone who grew up to be a poet, were the roots of it in that school in any way?
Yeah, well, you know, you had to learn a verse, Os Gaeilge and Os Berle, every night, a verse.
Yeah.
And you had to have it by heart the next day or you were beaten. So that's a great inducement to get the lines graven into your memory and your soul.
And what kind of stuff were you learning?
Well, actually, Miss Shannon had a very, very eclectic taste. So we would have to learn, for instance, Easter 1916 off by heart.
The whole
thing.
I have
met them at close of day, coming with vivid faces from counter or desk among grey 18th century houses. I have passed with a nod of the head or polite, meaningless words. I've lingered a while and said polite, meaningless words, you know, and I could go on.
Well, you remember it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure Mr. Yeats would approve of that delivery, but there we are.
Totally.
But she was on it in terms of the rhythm, yeah.
But the lines grave in.
Exactly,
you
yeah.
know, the lines grave in. But I think also that it's beaten out of you, you know. So it's a lot of people, when you say poetry, a look of horror, a blanch, their faces blanch and the look of horror comes over.
I had to go through that routine with a poem called Young Lochinvar. Do you know that one?
On.
Did you ever do that one?
Oh, no.
And that was one. No. It was a lot of verses and you were strapped, you know, if you didn't remember them all. And eventually it got to the last, you know, the last man standing who finally got through the entire poem. It's an extraordinary thing, though. But I remember it. I'm not advocating it, though. I don't want to remember it. I couldn't care less who young Lochinvar is. He's an old man by now anyway.
Yeah.
But it was a similar
the boy
thing.
Boy stood on the burning deck. Oh, boy, I hope he drowned.
Lochinvar has come out of the west through all the wide valley. His steed was the best. Actually, I don't remember it. That's it.
But I mean, one line, two lines, carries you on.
So obviously that was an introduction to poetry. But certainly at that point, there would have been no conception of writing it down for yourself, of writing some kind of poetry. Was there?
No, absolutely. Yeah. I mean,
so how early was that?
Oh, really early. But in fact, I got into trouble because Miss Shannon, probably with good reason, I was always trying to give poems instead of the three-page essay, which was demanded of us as children. Like the primary cert, you had to leave with the 3 hours. It was quite severe reading, writing and arithmetic, right? So, you know, they took that very seriously. So I had learned, my grandfather taught me to read and write before I went to school with quite a remarkable system of his own. He would give me pages of his newspaper and a soft pencil, very black. And he started with the letter O, and he got me to fill in all the O's in the newspaper. So I'm a patterner. I got into these patterns, you know, and the lovely patterns where you get 2 O's, like in moon or swoon or mood. So I learned O's, and then I learned A's, filling in columns of it, because newspapers were in columns then, filling it in. And somewhere between, you know, the little enclosed space of R and W, maybe, the transition onto the other ones that didn't have enclosed spaces, I was reading.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, I went into school with that skill. So school was generally a doddle because I could decode a lot of what was going on, including the weirdnesses, you know.
But you wouldn't have been allowed to hand in a poem instead of your three-page essay
there.
Oh,
murder.
Yeah.
Murder out the side of the class, because Miss Shannon kind of knew me, and she also knew that I would be trying to minimise the effort involved. You know, if you could get away with like 3-4 lines.
How little you knew about poetry then, if you thought it was going to be less of an effort
to write three lines. I know. I was deluded big time.
All right, your next musical choice, Cormac Branagh.
Yeah.
So tell me about this.
Again, it kind of has a strange kinked relationship with motherland, because I came to young teenagehood in the early 70s. And of course, that was, as you would know, John, the time when all that stirring stuff was just the bottom of the lake was being stirred up north and south, you know, all these elements were coming. And Cormac, this is a new album just arrived in around the time you offered me this invitation. So I thought it was germane, and it was there, came in for a reason. He's developing this project, which goes on the road in January and includes these tunes. And he's Cormac Branagh, 1976, the Salins train robbery. It'd be millions in today's money. But the train was held up at Salins. And there were arrests. I think 5 members of the Irish Republican Socialist Party were lifted, including Cormac's brother, Oscar, and including the more famous Nicky Kelly.
All right, yeah, of course.
Now, they were in the hands of the Heavy Gang. That's what the gang in the police were called, the Heavy Gang. They were severely beaten, tortured. All this came out in subsequent court cases, and they received a presidential pardon eventually. It was a very dark time. And all these years later, Cormac, who would have been a child at the time, and very much in this project, takes the child's eye view of what it's like to have a notorious brother who is readied up and who got, I think he got 12 years hard service, hard labour, penal servitude. And I remember the marches for Nicky Kelly. I remember taking part in them.
And there were songs and so
there
on, songs weren't there?
Free Nicky Kelly.
Yeah.
And the best piece of graffiti ever, because it went up all over Dublin, Free Nicky Kelly. And of course, the addendum with every packet of cornflakes, you know. And I love that. It's like that other great bit of graffiti in the toilets in Grogan's years ago. My mother made me a lesbian. If I give her the wool, would she knit me one? Yeah, so, you know. But all joking aside, that kind of darkness. So Cormac is a whistle player. So the album is called Whistleblower. And I mean, there's still elements of that that have never been reconciled. But what interests me about this album and this track specifically is it's an attempt to take the trauma of that time and actually turn it into something powerful and strong, and in some way to, although I'm very suspicious of ideas of healing through art, you know, I think maybe that happens, but it has to be something
else. We'll have to return to this now.
Yeah. I think it happens, but I think, you know, to be going around like a snake oil salesman isn't going to do either the art or the craft any good. So this particular track is based on a poem of Limo Muirhile, one of our great Irish language poets who died this year. And it's called Aron Namna Favla, the song of the women flourishing, or I like to think of them breaking into flower. And it's a tribute to the Brannock's Oscar and Cormac's mother, who held all that time together. So that's what I mean about looking back, but in order to kind of retrieve what was human from, because you can imagine the kind of bullying and the kind of attitude of neighbours and the community to this, what was it, a major miscarriage of justice. So this is also our motherland and has to be sorted and reconciled.
Music there from Cormac Brannock. It's called Fuivla, instrumental from an album called The Whistleblower, the choice of Paula Meehan, the poet who's with me in studio tonight. You were just saying there, Paula, you touched on this about the capacity or otherwise, or the pressure or otherwise on poets in particular sometimes to sort things out and to bring about national healing and other things that aren't easy to do. And you expressed a certain reservation about that notion.
Yes, because I think of poetry as a completely free, sovereign space, you know. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if, certainly just speaking personally, that my best work doesn't come out of sitting down with agendas at all.
Sure.
It comes out of a kind of a free and radical service to language. So we live in a time when there are and have been pressures put on, certainly on me and other poets, other artists, to be part of the reconciliation of history in our time. So we've come through the commemorative years and there's been beautiful things made, operas, novels, dramas, poetry galore, songs, song cycles. Like, it's been a really rich time for responding to material of the past. To me, in the recent, the revolutionary era commemoration, like the 1913 to 1916 cycle, I've seen fantastic stuff made by my contemporaries. But for me, the most moving memorial things I saw, acts of memorialization, are the quilts that the communities make for their lost children, children lost to drug abuse, adult children and, you know, younger children. These are so profoundly moving to me, that communities who've lost their children through a kind of a state neglect, you know, going back into when like heroin hit the poor communities in the 80s. Gosh, if you even raised your head above the parapet, you were called a shinner or a provy, you know, the concerned parents against drugs, you know, those movements trying to ameliorate their own situations in the communities. So it seems to me that, you know, that we have to commemorate, and it's, you know, extraordinary new research is done. I mean, it's a fantastic time to be a young historian, with revisiting the archives and complicating the narrative, as Katrina Crowe, our great archivist, might say. And that those archives are opening up and yielding so much information. But as we move now towards the period where we're going to be looking at the Civil War, the War of Independence, the Civil War, the early days of the state, which seems to me to have been an establishment of a pretty much iron-clad theocracy, you know, those early years coming into the 30s, it seems like we can't actually stop looking at what's going on now, you know?
Now,
have to actually feed the what we discover from the past needs to feed how we look, the lenses that we bring to the traumas and issues that are happening now.
But this particularly what's coming up is going to bring forth extraordinarily difficult territory and complications that we're not, most people aren't even aware of, I think, particularly the Civil War.
Yeah.
Because people don't know how bad it was
and what
people did to each other.
And what people did.
And did to their relatives and that kind of thing. So when all this stuff starts to come out, it's going to be emotionally difficult, I think, for the country. Is that not the situation where you need the poet? Especially when you need the poet, actually, to sort of to weigh in there and kind of articulate what's going on or somehow steady people and put some shape on potential chaos, you know?
Now, that sounds to me like you're looking for the poet to step into a kind of a leadership role that may have been taken in the past by priests. And I'm very suspicious of that.
No, I don't mean that. I mean just to say something, whether it's to be published in the paper or appear on the Late Late Show or something and deliver something. And people might go, I like that. I'll cut it out and I'll keep it in my pocket or I'll keep it in my wallet and I'll read it now and again and it steadies me a bit. That's all.
I'm looking at you.
I know you are.
A dose of scepticism.
Let's start at the more personal level first of all. Okay, people often reach for a poem, particularly reach for a poem, at a time of either celebration or disaster. You know, someone dies, or they get married, or there's a child christened, or it's not necessarily a bad good and bad.
And that, I think that's really powerful that people associate poetry with threshold experience.
And it does them a load of good.
Yeah.
Right. Now, can that be? What's the word I'm talking about? Extrapolated, or can it be increased to cover more of us, a group of people, a society, a country?
I don't know that the poet's role is amenable to that. If it happens, I think great.
Well, let's leave aside the poet's role because I agree with you. It's not your job to do that.
Yeah.
But it can become your poem can become that thing.
But the funny thing is, people take ownership.
Mm-hmm.
You can write away till the cows come home on this, that, and the other. You know, on the grand subjects. But actually, people take ownership of the poem they need. And that's often surprising. It has surprised me in my own life, the poems that people have taken, sometimes communities, sometimes, you know, in terms of different struggles, like in the repeal campaign, the statue of the Virgin at Granard, one of my poems was taken.
That's what I'm thinking of.
But
that's,
I didn't write that
of
anything.
I know.
I wrote it out of my own demons and my own need to make sense of the world. So, but I do think there's a place where you can negotiate between your own obsessional and demanding kind of drive and what is simply asked. And I think I always take it as great honour if someone comes and asks me for a poem, whether it's a neighbour asking me for a poem for a child's birthday, or it's, coming through one of the official arts channels for some commemorative. And I would take it seriously. And if I take on a commission, I take it incredibly. I'll give it everything and I will try and make it more than an occasional piece. But I think it's very and I would hate to become the kind of poet who goes around looking for opportunities to be inflicting commemorative gestures on the poor people of the country.
Probably a few of them on the phone right now, hustling for the next couple of years.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, but there'd be work for artists in it.
But for instance, your Granard poem, you know, of course you didn't sit down to write that with any idea what would become of it.
Yeah.
But something did become of it, you know.
Yes.
And I'm
very honoured by that and again, moved by it.
And that's what I mean. I think in certain circumstances, maybe it's not the poet that's needed. It's a poem.
Yeah.
And a poem is somehow found by people and held on to. So there's a huge importance in poetry.
I think so. And you've put your finger on something too, that this is one of the things that makes me love this country and love living here. That, you know, the motherland has this still this, and it may be a vestigial kind of belief in poetry from a time when maybe the few words in the ditch, you know, mm-hmm. the hedge school, the sense of a culture under pressure and a culture that was somehow had to fly under the radar and maybe you had to just pass as the way in America, you know, you pass as white to survive, you know, you pass as part of a colony. So there's a lot of complex reasons why poetry still seems to mean something here. Mm. But, you know, there's you know, remember the images of, you know, we lived the last phase of the revolutionary era. We lived it through televised reports from the barricades in the north, you know. Remember all, you know, there's so much trauma to be examined and somehow brought into the light and integrated, reconciled. I mean, it's a huge job ahead over the next few years. And I suspect an awful lot of people will turn off as well. You know, enough is enough. People were saying that around the commemorative work around 1916, that there was a point at which they just couldn't bear. They just couldn't bear more of it.
Mm. Well, this is going to be tougher.
Yeah.
What's coming up?
I know.
Anyway, your next musical choice, and I noticed the first half of this is quite kind of folky,
mm-hmm.
for one, and then it there's a few curveballs coming down the track, I have to say, but we're still here with this is a Richard Thompson song sung by Christy.
Yes, because this song I loved it. I loved it in Richard Thompson's iteration. And I loved it. I went to see him in Vicar Street a few years ago, maybe 3 years ago. And I made a fantastic discovery of that amazing talent, Lisa O'Neill, yeah. who was supporting him. Yeah. And I went to see him and I came away just absolutely blown away by her.
She's the real deal, that one.
I think Richard Thompson is a great songwriter. I mean, and a guitarist. And he would have been part of my youth, you know, the English folk scene, Sandy Denny, Fairport. I mean, I was traipsing around in long, streely dresses, tripping the light, fantastic. But I love Christie's version of it. And I love the figure in it, this woman who just will not be contained. She's a vagabond, and even a Romany caravan was too much like settling down. So this kind of spirit in her, really, I would relate to it. I was a bit of a rambler in my own youth. And of course, she comes to a sad end nursing a bottle in a doorway somewhere. And I always think that is the road not taken for me.
And that's Christy there singing a Richard Thompson song, Bee's Wing, the choice of Paula Meehan, who's with me in studio. We're going to take a quick break. We'll get more of Paula's choices after this. And this is Mystery Train, RTE Lyric FM, until 9 o'clock, Sunday night, the special where we get someone to pick the tunes. And tonight it's the poet Paula Meehan. Paula, you talked about the poetry that you were exposed to in school mm-hmm. and it was beaten into you and all the rest of it. When did you first write some poetry of your own and think, you know, I'm onto something here?
Yeah, very early. I mean, I started as a child and it just continued. The first poem I published was in a kind of a youth magazine out in Finglas, edited by a guy called Dave Burke. And this would have been the generation before, say, Lipton Village and Bono and the lads. But it was all music. I mean, it was all music. We were music mad. It was all bands. It was all boys with guitars. And it was fantastic nurturing. And I wanted at that stage to be writing songs because I thought, yeah, that's it. That's the way to go, songwriting. And I can write the poems, so I'll write the songs. But in fact, that soon became apparent that all these boys with guitars, you know, that I wasn't really getting a look in. And that the solitary life of the poet was actually what I was fated to do. But my first poem was published openly at 16 in that youth magazine in Finglas. And it had such an effect and it brought me so much trouble that I didn't publish again till I was in my 20s.
Okay, well, Why did it bring you so much trouble?
I don't know. People coming up to me, you know, are you the poet? Did you write that?
Yeah.
That's shite. You know, you can imagine.
I know. Just a check. Yeah.
And then it probably had some sexual overtone. So, you know, that got...
Stuff you're not supposed to know about.
Brought its own stuff. So I thought, oh, no, no. And I withdrew a bit. But we were always into songs. I mean, that was the currency. And the lyric thing was huge. And my good friends of the time were all mad into songwriting. The blues were very popular. The first album I bought, vinyl album, was John Mayall, Blues from Laurel Canyon. Each and every morning when the sun is high, I hunt around the canyon till I find a place to lie. Oh, it's so beautiful to be alone. I've got the sun and sea in silence. I'm in my Laurel Canyon home. Now, why like a 14-year-old in Finglas would find that riveting is a mystery to me. You know, how do you find these lines? They are the song lines.
Well, I mean, John Mayall wasn't from Laurel Canyon either.
No, not at all. He was an English guy. And the English blues thing was big in Finglas. There was a fantastic blues guitarist called Niall McMahon, eventually went with his young wife to England, and they'd a band there. And they would have then tuned into people like the Pogues and Philip Chevron. It was all that. And my great friend was John Borrowman, who was a poet, first of all, and then a member of Theatrix. And John, I remember, you know, coming into teenage times and starting to get into a lot of trouble. I remember his mother coming up to talk to my mother to say I was a bad influence on him, which is absolutely hilarious. Anyone who knew John.
Well, how were you affected, Paula, by the arrival of, you mentioned Lipton Village there, which developed
that
into...
That was later. The next generation.
That was later. But when I'm thinking, you know, Virgin Prunes and U2 and so on, but people like the Atrix and so on, that was a very different scene which kind of turned its back on John Mayall and Bob Dylan and Van Morrison. Now, it kind of turned its back.
Strange.
Or else didn't know about them at all.
Oh, no, they did. Sure, we listened to nothing else when we were kids, like young teenagers.
Yeah, but that was the big affectation of punk, wasn't it? That nobody knew who Joni Mitchell was.
Exactly. And I was away travelling between, like, I'd say the mid-70s up until really early 80s. I was travelling all over Europe. I was studying in the States. I was a rambler. And when I came back and Theatrix was a fact, these kids that I had hung around with in my early teens were now Theatrix, and they were going for the big time and they were great and the energy was fantastic. But there was a certain, the punk thing had happened. And so all of our early years were kind of overlaid by this punk stuff. But I mean, the real nourishment was people like Joni Mitchell, Blue. I mean, I think we all knew every single word of Blue off by heart. Mm. I mean, we listened to those vinyl albums still. They were probably graven flat, the grooves in them. It was fantastic. And of course, it was psychedelia. You know, big time. Like, by then, our family had moved out to Finglas as I was coming into my teens. So that was just a fantastic milieu. I mean, I'm again, like, it's like Finglas in the rare old times. You know, because I hung around with the boys with the long hair and the girls in the streely dresses, we spent a lot of our time dodging the skinheads, you know, the Cider and Mogadon gang, because they were absolutely, we were the enemy, you know.
Because you mentioned the Atrix, let's just play them now. We plan to play them a little bit later on, but let's do
now,
it.
Now, this is the later Atrix, not the young lads I knew.
I know, but still, your pal is amongst them.
Yeah, exactly, okay. Borman.
Treasure on the Wasteland. Treasure on the Wasteland, the Atrix there, the choice of Paula Meehan, who's with me in studio tonight, and John Borrowman there. He was saying, Paula, was a very fine poet, actually.
He published two collections, Weekends, and then the same, my first collection and John's second collection were launched the same night, Beaver Row Press. His second collection was Master of None.
Now, when kids come to you and ask you about working class culture,
how
do you respond to that? What is it?
I just tell them stories about what I did when I was young, you know, my misspent youth.
Because there is a theory nowadays that whatever there once was in terms of working class culture, it no longer exists. That's a theory, that there's actually nothing anymore. The working classes have been devastated and wiped out.
Well, no work, the world of no work. Yeah. You know, Hartnett's lines, they drive us to a world of total work. Yeah.
But what do you say to them? What you know, if a kid comes into you, as you say, and says, well, if the first question is, so Paul, I mean, what is working class culture?
I couldn't approach it from a theoretical basis. Yeah. All I can say is, this is what I saw, this is what I did, this is what my friends did. But, you know, I was at a lecture, a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine, a great poet, Harry Clifton, in Trinity, and I heard him utter the immortal words, all Irish poets are middle class, you know, and I resist that. Mm. And yet I know the process of getting an education has given me certain kinds of values. But, you know, when I want to touch base, it's back to the places like Finglas or Sean McDermott Street that I go to touch base with things that I need to hold on to as reality, as something that's real.
And how different would you say Finglas and Sean McDermott Street and all those places you talk about, how different are they today than when you were a youngster there?
Well, you see, the amazing thing in our recent history has been that it's those very because, I mean, even by the time I was being, you know, educated, we were being trained for a work environment that no longer existed, you know, to go into the sweatshops or go into service. That's what a young girl was getting trained for in the 50s and 60s in Ireland, you know, in a working class area, to go into the factories. But the factories were already starting to be, you know, protected species. What would I say? I just tell them the truths of my life. I can't theorise it. Though there is work, extraordinary work done on working class writing. Michael Pearce up in Belfast has done a lot of work. And, you know, in the critical milieu and the universities, it's, you know, there are theories. I don't live a theoretical life.
No, but there's lots of people, you know, who leave the community that they grew up in for various reasons. And often it is education and they move somewhere else and they do something else. But they can go back there and they can slip back in there and feel utterly comfortable.
Oh, totally.
Like, you know, you like being home in the middle of where it was you were. And maybe your children or your grandchildren are looking at it and thinking, my God, what's the deprivation, on? You know?
I know.
But yet it's your background. But from the perception would be that some of the places you're talking about are so riddled with drugs and all the rest of it that they would be unrecognisable from what they were when you were a kid. But maybe not.
I mean, okay, so there wasn't heroin, but there was alcohol. Mm. You know, there's a history of trauma. And when they demolished the tenements, they kind of decanted the trauma into the new social housing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Herbert Sims' beautiful Art Deco buildings, the red bricks around the city. You know, you don't, things don't change as quickly as you think. Mm. But I suppose I do think that, you know, I would have gotten involved in theatre when I was young, you know, coming into my 20s, City Workshop, the Sheridan Brothers down, you know, those plays, which were an attempt to actually present on stage working class theatre. You know, the history, the three plays that City Workshop did, Kipps, The Digs, The Village, which looked at the Monto area, then Pledges and Promises, which looked at the decline of the docks, and then A Hape of Junk, which looked at heroin hitting the communities. You know, that theatre energy that tried to say, look, it's not all about the official story. The narrative is complicated and these are other stories. I think that's a very valid and fruitful and necessary pushing. And it's always pushing under. But those communities you mentioned now are totally multicultural.
Yeah.
I mean, hip hop, spoken word. I remember going into Finglas just years ago now, might be even a decade ago. And one of my old neighbours comes and says, Paula, there's a new poet on the block. I say, yeah, what's happening? Oh, temperamental miscellaneous.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I know Elaine now. She's just in her last year in art college in NCAD, you know. But she was like, and that's, she's coming up from underneath, you know. It's coming, and I love that. I love that each generation has this energy, and it comes out of the deprived areas, whether they're called proletarian, working class, post-working class, mm-hmm. whatever they're called. And now they're the areas, because those small, those poor areas actually gave space to the new Irish, to the immigrant communities. So they were the first off the block with new energy. Mm-hmm. They gave them that room to get in there and make a life. Mm-hmm.
Polly, your next musical choice needs no introduction because it starts with a snare drum. And that's Bob Dylan, Like a Rolling Stone, the choice of Paula Meehan is with me in studio. Paula, how does it feel? How did it feel when his Bobness won the Nobel?
Were you it was fantastic.
Delighted?
Yeah. I was at a quayside, sitting drinking coffee at a quayside on an island, on a Greek island actually.
Lovely.
The lives of the poets.
Exactly.
And I got a text from your publisher and mine, Pat Boran. A text came in saying, "Did you hear the news about Bob?" And we went, myself and Theo, we went into a total tailspin of misery. We thought he died. Did you hear the word about Bob?
Yeah.
Oh no, how terrible. And we were in a state of grief. So Theo rang Pat to see, what happened to him? No, he got the Nobel. So like jubilation once again. I mean, I was so happy. I couldn't have been happier if they'd given it to me personally. Because, you know, he is the poet. He's given us so much. He's given us a whole lifetime. And he is a great artist.
You see, I assumed, because I'm a huge fan of his, assumed that was a sort of undisputed.
Yeah.
And yet, and I don't want to fight this battle again, but all the sniffy people came out of the woodwork saying he shouldn't get it.
Well, I call them Dylan deniers, you know.
But it seems ridiculous to even attempt to deny what he's done, you know.
Oh, I couldn't. I don't understand it. Mm. It's one of those mysteries, and I file it under mystery because he's just opened the ground. Mm. He really has for the lyric. He is the man, you know. And all those lines, I mean, his songs have saved me. There's no doubt about it. Times like, I mean, to have that height of scorn to throw back at a world that's ill-treating you, to have that scorn to throw in the face of bureaucrats and people who don't understand.
Now, we were talking about the power of poetry earlier on and indeed the role of the poet and the role of the writer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then you just said Bob's songs have saved me and all that. So there's no denying that.
In mind and to be able to lay them out. And I used a line from that song as the epigraph to one of my collections, Dara Micaiah. And it's when you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose. And I coupled it with a line from the great Russian poet, Anna Akhmatova. She says, "There is nothing you can give a poet, nothing you can take away." So, you know, it really stands up for language and for truth. And yeah, for me now, he is a profound artist. You know, do the work seems to be his real transmission. Do the work. Put that, you know, I believe that I've never in my life asked for a poetry reading. I'm not even someone who likes to send work to journals or that, because it kind of distracts from my, you know, bigger plans. But I think there's something about making the work and letting it draw to you and taking what it draws to you, you know, trusting it. And I think he's a great exemplar of that. He put it out and he did it on his own terms and does it on his own terms. And he's a consummate artist.
But the point I'm making though is when you find yourself being described as the voice of a generation or a prophet, which is often used, you know, would you attach words like prophet or things like that to poets? Or certain poets, that they have some kind of
there is
special
prophetic utterance, going back to the Sibyls and going back to the oracles. There is prophetic utterances. There's mysterious utterance. There's even apocalyptic utterance. Mm-hmm. Like if you look at something like the Book of Revelations, John the Revelator. But I mean, you also have to factor in he was writing in the first century AD in Patmos, where there was a huge mushroom cult, you know. So I mean, there's glossolalia that can present as prophecy.
Yeah.
And there's states of glossolalia that they're put out there and you just make of them, because they're so open to interpretation. You take what you want out of them and you can look like a prophet. You know?
But you see, the thing is, I wouldn't call Bob Dylan a prophet because he doesn't want to be called one.
No,
and yet you listen to the songs and you go, maybe he is.
Well, I don't think he wants to be boxed in or labelled in a way that's reductive.
Yeah.
Who does?
Because that wouldn't help. Yeah.
No. But what he is, and what is really evident and gets more evident as time goes on, we see that he is a great scholar of the song. I mean, a profound scholar of the song, who had access to Lomax's archive through one of his girlfriends, who had that kind of scholarly, deep scholarly inclination to understand. He was the last generation in America to study Latin in school. Mm. It was off the curriculum after him. And he's very informed by, he has deep, deep learning.
I also think he's one of those unique people that I think everything that he's read, and he's read a lot, he can retrieve it from his brain.
Or he can spin it in a line.
Yeah, but he's got it. Whereas the rest of us read books and forget them straight away. Anyway, we could talk about Bob for too long. Let's move on to, well, where do we go from here? There's a list. There's a list here. I mean, what about Joni?
Yeah, let's do that. Absolutely.
Which one do you want, Amelia?
Well, that's the one, yeah. That's the one I have.
Beautiful song.
Yeah.
And that's Joni Mitchell's song called Amelia, the choice of Paula Meehan, the poet who's with me in studio. Mm. Paula, now, if my listeners will forgive me asking you the question that we ask every time Joni Mitchell gets played on this programme, which is, I'm always amazed at how someone like Joni Mitchell or Bob Dylan or any of these people could write those kind of words when they're very, very young, on the basis that you would assume at that age, I could be completely wrong, that they wouldn't have known a whole lot, they mightn't have been that wise. You know, I'd expect Dylan to write something very smart now in his 70s. Mm-hmm. But when you're 21 or you're 20, or Kate Bush writing things when she was 18, or Sandy Denny when she was 17. Yeah. I mean, when I was that age, I couldn't do anything. And I certainly couldn't have written anything that could last and survive and would make sense many, many decades later, you know? Now, what normally comes up is we just dismiss it and say, well, we'll not dismiss it, but our explanation is, well, it's just genius. That's the end of it. But you think there might be more to it than that? Language itself holds some kind
of... I mean, we are servants. Anyone who is involved in lyric is a servant of the language itself, of the words themselves. And Pasternak says, each word carries its ghosts around with it. And I think he just doesn't mean etymology, like where the word comes from, its roots. You know, the language itself has wisdom and power. And if you're working in a tradition, as they are writing in the song tradition, and they're writing out of having a back catalogue in their own minds of songs of others. So they're always spinning a line. It's a, you know, and they've the well-stocked mind of the song lovers who then go on to make songs is you're pulling all the time either the tune of the line, you know, the rhythm or the conceits of the line or the metaphor of the line. And these like the generation of the romantic poets, you know, are nearly all dead by the age of 30, like Shelley and Keats and that. You know, you get these generations that are just kind of almost catapulted into a huge arena. But that I think you trust what you make, and the learning of the craft is a kind of a stability. It is a path, as other kinds of paths in life, and there is a stability in it. Like, you know, Joni Mitchell, when she was writing those, like Blue even, which is a masterpiece, and I could probably reconstruct from memory every song. I remember once travelling with Cullum Tobin around the south of France. We were on tour, a literary tour, and pastime in the car, we used to sing... We both had all of Blue off by heart, the entire album. Mm. You know, they're so well made, they're so memorable, and it's about memory. So I think often artists, especially when they're young, they're not just working out of themselves, because quite often young artists are completely messed up, as Joni was and as Bob went in and out of phases of, you know, been on the edge, as many of us have. But, you know, if you have a trade, and it is on a very practical level, you have a trade and you get up in the morning and it's not just idle genius moving through you, though there is that.
Yeah.
But it's the journey, as Ivan Boland put it memorably, from self-expression to art. That journey from the impulse to actually learning how to manage a line, how to even rhyme in a way that has power and force and isn't just, it's also about not just being ornamental, because then you just recreate the songs of the previous generation without pushing them further along. So I think it's very similar with poetry. There are many analogies that, you know, you can start to write in any generation a poetry that's just ornamental.
Mm-hmm.
And Coleridge talks about the difference between a real image and a fancy. And fancy is just reconstructing ornamental stuff from the past, whereas image, deep image, has power of and in itself.
And how far would you go down the mystical, supernatural kind of route in terms of where all this stuff comes from?
Oh, to the edge, John.
Really?
To the end, John.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's zeitgeist, the spirit of the age. And you see that. I mean, I'm in my 60s now, so I've watched a few zeitgeists force young artists into poetry, into dance, into music, into visual expression, film. You know, the zeitgeist moving through communities, especially the communities of the disaffected young. That's why I always say give young people a lot of space in what they're tuning into and what they're doing. That, you know, that's how the zeitgeist presents itself and moves into wider culture.
Yeah,
because most of the things that we were being really hammered for and really criticized isn't the word, but when we were kids, have just moved mainstream big time.
But then the zeitgeist notion, that conjures up just ideas that things could be influenced by advertising and television and, you know, just fashion.
Yeah, but I'm talking about the resistance that comes with each generation to everything that's gone before.
Well, what about whatever word you'd use for it now, what they used to call the muse, that there is some other force, yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know if she's other. I wouldn't other her, as the academics say.
Right, so it's the muse is a she.
Well, for me, she is. So there have been women have had male muses. Adrienne Rich, the great American poet, had in some of her earlier work a male muse. But my muse would be definitely, I nearly smell her as female around me. And when she's around me, I feel, you know, I really feel it. And this is a projection. Like, it's obviously something that's in me or, you know, I don't think it's any kind of, it might be mysterious, but I don't think it's unhuman or impractical. But certainly I feel it as a force. And she's fairly determined. Like, she is like Keats's La Belle Dame sans merci. She is without mercy. And she doesn't dispense her favours fairly. Like, I can work and work and work at a poem and it can be absolute rubbish. And somebody, just maybe their first poem even, can just come along and, you know, this whatever's moving through them finds perfect expression.
Well, just to go back on what you said, even though you talk about the muse as a real presence and as a she and all the rest of it, what you're also saying is it's a projection and it's part of yourself. It's not actually some other kind of ghost figure or some other, you know, separate presence.
I don't know. We're up against the edge and we could just deteriorate into vague mystical talk here, John. But
You're not being vague about it at all. You said you can smell her.
I know, yeah, exactly.
Don't vague about that.
But if I try to kind of explain, I mean...
Well, don't explain.
In any rational terms, because it's not rational. It could happen when the moon is full, you know. It's in some ways, it's a surrender.
Right.
You know? It's a surrendering to a force. And now, This begs the fact, what do you do about getting enough time to sit down and surrender to forces?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we live these lives that are dementedly busy and we're tyrannized by machines in the daily. So, you know, the opportunity for surrender often has to be created and made, you know, to get the world a bit on the edge, get it out there and get the space to make new work.
I think it might be time for this one. Van Morrison there, and Into the Mystic, the choice of Paula Meehan, who's with me in studio. Now, we don't want to talk any further about muses and the rest of it, because we don't want to jinx anything in terms of the creative process.
Could drive her away.
Yeah, drive her away. Now, there is one aspect that I do want to ask you about. Now, your partner, Theo Dorgan, is also a poet.
Yeah.
Now, how does that work when you've got two poets at work in the one household?
Yeah,
and maybe only one muse
out in Baldoyle.
Yeah, maybe only one muse between you. How does that work?
Oh yeah, mine is totally mine. His is totally his. It works well because we understand the strange spaces. We might go to the abstraction. Mm-hmm. When you're chasing a poem, when you're on the hunt for it, and the need to disconnect from everything at times, if you can. We understand that. So we give you, I know when he's in a phase of creativity, and I give him loads of room and space. So we do respect that space. He's a great reader, so I always listen to what he has to say. I don't necessarily take the advice, but he's a good sounding board, and I often read his. He's often my first reader, and I'm often his first reader. So I also try not to lay my stuff, you know, to keep that he has his things to work out, long-term things, mm-hmm. and I've long-term things. And I don't think we'd censor each other because we're, you know, close. You know the way you can be you can be censoring yourself in some ways so you don't hurt other people.
Sure.
With the ferocity of the things you say.
Yeah.
So I think we've kind of come into some kind of balance around that we do feel free enough to write the poems we have to write and go for them.
Yeah, that self-censorship thing is very interesting, isn't mm-hmm. it? I mean, some poets don't or some writers don't write their best stuff until both their parents are gone for a start. That happens. Yeah. You know, because they don't want their mammy reading it.
Yeah.
That's a true one for a lot of people, I think.
Yeah. You know, that you can't choose the moment of resolution. That's part of your human journey when material from the past needs to be resolved. But I think you do learn strategies for not disguising it or not hiding, but for language allows you great protection. When people say to me, Janie, and they used to say it to me, and sometimes still, how can you, you know, reveal so much of yourself? How can you put all that personal stuff out there? But in fact, I don't experience it as personal or as anything, because language itself and the lines, the making, is terrific battle dress. It is. I think that the making is its own protection. I feel that that's my poetic license in a way. So I don't feel, I can feel vulnerabilities around what I put out or what I make. But I also feel that the making gives me battle dress. It is also a mask, you know. So it's not my own ego isn't involved or on the line with the poem. I love that about poetry and about the life in poetry, that the making of it actually is the protection.
Yeah, yeah, good point. Next musical choice is, we've time for a few more, what's this Sugarito Bambo?
Ah, yeah, Sue. Sue is, I met her through the Irish poet Keith Payne. He introduced me to her. He brought her to Ireland. She had been here busking. And in fact, she's just been awarded some huge prize over there in Galicia. She's a singer-songwriter. She came to Dublin, was busking around the city. And she says that gave her her soul. That gave her the place where she could be strong. But she's put some of my work to music and sung it. But she puts this lovely poem of Keats. It's a Grey Stones. And if you've ever, have you ever lived in the Irish countryside poor?
No.
No.
I haven't lived in the Irish countryside.
Okay, well then.
Rich or poor.
Yeah, well
Midland.
I have. I've lived poor in the Irish countryside. You know where you have to like walk 3 miles to a post office to buy a bottle of milk?
Yeah.
If you have enough left over to buy the bottle of milk and the few fags. And it's just that, and it always seems to be raining. And it always seems to be that the post office is closed by the time you get there and you don't get a lift, you don't get hitch a ride, you get drowned by traffic driving past you on lonely country roads where
sounds
there might
wonderful.
Be another. Yeah, it's the real act Irish country living experience. Forget all those magazines with agas in them, right? So Sue, who is an extraordinary Galician singer-songwriter, who, in fact, I think she brings back to Ireland something of the Milesians, because her people live up in the ancient, up the mountain in the ancient forests, the oak forests, where they have like portal tombs and the exact same megalithic standing stones as our own ancestors. So I think she brings some of that home, and she studies Sean Nose.
This is called,
anyway, here she is.
Grey Stones, Sue Garrido Pombo. Sue Garrido Pombo, Grey Stones, that's called, a Galician singer with a song written by Keith Penn, the Irish poet, the choice of the Irish poet, Paula Meehan, who's been with me tonight picking all the tracks. Really enjoying this tonight, Paula, I must say. Thanks a million for putting together all these wonderful tracks. If you were in a band now, I'd say, have you any gigs coming up, and when's your next album?
Oh, so. Well, I have been working this autumn on putting together my collected poems.
Collected?
Can you believe that? Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So I have digitised all the early work, which was pre-cyber world, and it's all there. And, you know, I keep saying, okay, I'll only publish the last five. My problem is the first two books, right, which I kind of learnt my trade in, whether I should publish them as part of the collected or jump in at my third book, which I think is maybe where I really get into the flow. And it's one of the problems of publishing early, your juvenilia. You wouldn't know anything about
would
that
you?
Because
no,
you came straight out with the fully formed, mature work.
Lit bloomer.
There's a lot to be said for that.
Well, in your case, Paula, you know, when you're going through all that material, so much material, did you find yourself, I don't know, pleasantly surprised by stuff you thought mightn't be that good?
Absolutely horrified.
Or completely horrified. Completely horrified by stuff.
Completely, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose I felt, you know, a lot of compassion for how confused I was back then.
But it's easier.
But
I can see
that there's somebody there who is absolutely committed. Yeah. You know, there's no two ways about it. Right from the get-go, I was putting everything on the line.
Can't be hard on yourself.
I do actually think she had a lot more courage than I have today.
Well,
she was less fearful.
Separate person you're talking about now.
Totally. Totally.
But yeah, you're not being smart by saying that. You believe that separate person, another person.
Well, I just think, considering how many roads there were diverging in that yellow wood, I think, you know, the fact that I've come to this stage relatively together in my head, touch wood, in one piece, and, you know, have at least ameliorated some of the damage I did when I was younger, that I feel just gratitude, absolute gratitude. And I do feel that putting the collected poems together, because I'm into a new collection now, has given me that, reinforced my desire just to surrender to poetry again, you know.
And that collected, when do you think we might see that?
It might, now there's a long lead time for books. It might be 2020.
Right.
I think it's more likely to. And I kind of feel there's no rush till I make up my mind about the very early work, whether it should go in.
Well, it could be a separate book too, you know, and call it Juvenile, couldn't you? You could call it that.
Yeah, totally. Or an appendix. It might be an appendix.
Get your appendix out. Yeah, you can do that. Well, listen, Paula, thanks a million for coming in, and thanks for picking all this great music.
Thank you, John.
And we're going to finish with Anthony. Of Anthony and the Johnsons. Anthony now and Noni, but Anthony in this case. And it's a Leonard Cohen song. So listen, I'll have to give you an opportunity to introduce Leonard and tell me I can imagine what you're going to say. Why Leonard?
Oh, well, because the song is about surrender. Mm. And that's, I think the more we surrender in, in the world we live in that is so messed up and we hear so much rubbish every day coming at us and dangerous rubbish. It's just the clear lines of Leonard Cohen all the way through. Again, I think he gave us a path. You know, when people give out about all that, they're always, you know, when people want to give out, they say, oh yeah, depressive stuff in bedsits. But I think maybe he was saving people's lives in bedsits by giving them song lines to survive in.
Yeah, and very funny and very wise.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
All the time. And this one is, I mean, he would finish his concerts with this and it was quite a moment of, okay, we probably won't see you again, Leonard. Yeah. And that, unfortunately, was, even though he skipped off the stage, these would have been his last words.
Yeah. He's just a great exemplar for a life well lived.
Paula, thanks a million.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.